Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 17th of November. Monday is All Things Political, and our guest this hour is Professor Charles Lipson, a professor of political science and director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago. He also did live coverage for the BBC of the presidential election, and was in Chicago doing live broadcasts during the night of the Obama victory. We have a lot to talk about this hour. We'll be looking at the possible nomination of Senator Hillary Clinton to be Secretary of State. We'll look at who needs to be on a strong national security team and the issues that the new president will face when it comes to national security. Today, the president-elect will be meeting with his former rival, John McCain. We'll talk about what might be discussed at that meeting, other possible cabinet nominations. We will be looking at the direction that the Republicans are going and how they can be a strong opposition party or a strong party to work in a bipartisan fashion with the Democratic administration. So we have a lot on the table this hour, and we welcome your phone calls as always. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Should you want to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Charles Lipson, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Yeah, good morning. So what is it like to be at the center of power in the world, Chicago?
Well, they fixed my street. They fixed my street last week. And in Chicago, that's exactly what power is like, you know. You call up your alderman, and if your alderman is really well connected, you know, you get your street fixed there.
Well, that's good. It must be...
It was very exciting. Of course, Barack Obama lives in our neighborhood, and everybody has more than one story about knowing him or seeing him. And a lot of his key advisors are people that folks around here have known for a long time. I've known David Axelrod, for example, his chief strategist for 30 years.
Oh, my.
I've known Barack for a long time. And these are very impressive people, but the main feeling around here was that everybody had drunk the Kool-Aid.
I'm sure it was, and that will continue. Do you know if he's going to keep Chicago as sort of a Western White House or not? Will it be Hawaii?
No, he won't be. He'll be traveling around a lot, but he's going to have and he certainly plans to keep his home. The big issues on his table, though, will take up all of his time. And as you probably know, it's become a permanent presidential campaign.
Right. And he faces so many big issues, doesn't he?
He faces, I think, three sets of huge issues. One is the economic crisis. Bill Kristol's op-ed this morning in the New York Times had the headline, George W. Hoover. Mm. And I think that that captures it from Kristol's point of view as a Republican. The issue is, this is the worst economic meltdown since the Depression, and unless the Republicans come up with a coherent answer to it, they'll be out of power for a long time. That's one set of problems, and of course it's a big set of problems for everybody up and down Main Streets and Elm Streets and every other street. The second set of problems, I think, are health care. And one of the questions there is, will there be any money left after you finish bailing out everybody who needs bailing out? And then you get to all the foreign policy issues, including a war that seems to be going better in Iraq, but that will need to be wound down, a war that's not going quite so well in Afghanistan, with lots of problems on the tribal areas in Pakistan, and then the elephant in the room, which is the prospect of another terror attack, with Al-Qaeda rebuilding a lot of its assets, not only in the Pakistani border areas, but in lawless areas in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with the economic situation. He intimated last night and has before that he will put resources toward rebuilding an infrastructure in the United States, a jobs program. Some people have urged him to do an FDR kind of jobs program in this country. Does he have money to do that? Is it necessary? And how would he accomplish that?
Well, I suppose that the first issue is how bad is the immediate crisis? If the immediate crisis is stemmed from a meltdown in the financial system with what's called deleveraging, as everybody gets their loans called in effect what they have to do is pay off their borrowing with whatever assets they have. That means that people are engaged in a lot of fire sales. I think what you have to do there is staunch the bleeding before you can do rehab. And the rehab will include a lot of infrastructure. We had a bridge fall down, as I don't have to tell people in Wisconsin, up in Minnesota, with nothing that happened to it. In other words, it wasn't like a barge ran into the bridge. This is a bridge that fell down. We have a lot of infrastructure needs, old bridges, old sewers, all of that sort of thing. But those are long-term issues, and they will require taxes. He has pledged to raise taxes only on the wealthiest, even if you don't keep to his $250,000 limit on where that is, even if you go down a little bit from that, there's just a question as to whether that will that will harm the economy. There is one piece of good news in all of this, though, Kathleen, and that is the drop in oil prices is effectively a major tax cut.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about terrorism for a moment. You hate to live in this world where a possible terrorist attack could happen. What about this talk that he will be tested? He will be tested early in the administration. Can you give me an idea of the relative strength of al-Qaeda, if we've been able to monitor that, and why it's been that we've gone a fairly long time without any kind of attack? And would indeed some fringe of that group, some part of that group, consider an attack early in a new administration? I hate to even ask that, but I have
I understand why you hate to ask it. The first thing I'd say is that the test may not be from al-Qaeda. The test could be something like something that Russia does on one of its near borders. We have, in effect, let me take Russia for a second and then come to terror. What the Clinton administration did, and the Bush administration followed up on, but this is really a Clinton administration initiative, was that it expanded NATO right up to the edge of Russia. This would be like you know how nervous Americans get when the Soviets and now the Russians are fiddling with Cuba and Venezuela and so forth. Well, in effect, what the United States did was it brought its major alliance right up to the edge of Russia, and including some of the states that the Soviet Union and Russia before it and after it have traditionally dominated. One of the issues that happened in Georgia this summer was that the Russians showed that they can pounce back, and they moved in to areas with some ethnic Russian population, but they put the fear of Moscow right into all the Baltic countries, right into Ukraine, a number of other countries around there. And the Russians are one possible test. It's also possible that there'll be a meltdown in North Korea. We don't even know if the leader Kim Jong-il is Kim Jong-il or Kim Jong-dead. We really just don't have any clue. So the test that the administration faces could come anywhere. The United States has global interests. If it's a terror attack, it could be in the United States, or it could be on U.S. assets overseas, or it could be on one of our European or Asian allies. If it were an attack in London or Paris or Rome or something like that, then there would be a global response to that. But we would want to know where it came from, who was behind it, and all the rest.
Do we have any idea of the capability of terrorist organizations to inflict such damage in some part of the world? Are they unraveling? Are they getting stronger? Do we know who's getting information on this?
Well, let's take the long-term trend. The long-term trend is bad for the following reason. The lethality of what terrorist groups can do grows over time because it becomes easier fundamentally to build biological and chemical weapons using dual-use technologies. Nuclear comes in two fashions. One is a fission bomb. Nobody thinks that they have that or will have that for quite a while, although it would be devastating if they did. The other is what's called a dirty bomb, where in effect you pack radioactive materials like waste from X-rays around a regular bomb and then explode it in order to basically create radioactive debris that would clear out a downtown area or something like that for a long time until people could have it thoroughly scrubbed down. So these are all real terror attacks, or there could be, you know, a chemical attack in a subway. God knows what could happen, and it is a very frightening thing. Why have they not done so? One of the reasons that they haven't done so is that the United States and its European allies have spent a lot of time unraveling those networks. The second is that the leaders in the networks have spent a lot of time trying to protect themselves, get hidden in caves in the Afghan-Pakistan border area. They find it hard to communicate, hard to train their people. But they are not an organization a state university or General Electric, where somebody at the top calls somebody further down. It's much more decentralized than that. There is some central planning, but there are a lot of organizations out there that are kind of working toward the same goal. And one of the real problems has been the training of Islamic extremists who are natives to Germany, England, and so forth. They have the passports. They don't have to steal passports. They are natives of those countries. So there's a problem of integration of these groups. The reason we all have to take off our shoes at airports is not because of somebody who came from Asia. It's somebody who was raised in England.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the team that President-elect Obama needs to assemble in order to deal with these challenges. As you know, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the name has been mentioned. Bill Richardson, the name has been mentioned. He has been urged to put together a very strong national security team. How important are those nominations to confronting what you just outlined?
They're critically important. They would be critically important to any president, but they're even more important to a president who himself does not have a lot of foreign policy experience. One of the questions is whether he's going to go with the kind of softer half of the Clinton foreign policy team from the first two or three years of the Bill Clinton administration, or whether he's going to try to pick up people who are more associated with Hillary and the sort of tougher foreign policy team that the Clinton administration had in the second half. I just don't know what he's going to do. We'll get a sense of that when he appoints a national security advisor and key leaders. I actually think that another big question is going to be, what role does Joe Biden play in all of this? Biden fancies himself a foreign policy expert, and so will he play a Cheney-like role? That is, will the foreign policy portfolio be his? I wouldn't think that somebody like Hillary Clinton would even consider taking the job as Secretary of State unless she was the vicar of foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. And what about Senator John McCain's appearance in Chicago today? What's that all about?
Well, I thought that his concession speech in Arizona was actually masterful, and it was John McCain at his best. He was saying, we ran the best campaign we could, but we're all Americans. We pledge our support to Barack Obama, and we'll be the loyal opposition on some issues, but he didn't stress his opposition. This was a man who has devoted his entire adult life to the service of his country, and he was recognizing that this will be his last chance to become president of the United States. I thought it was a gracious concession speech. I think that the issues here will be, where does he see himself needing to oppose the president on foreign policy issues? How will they work together on issues like Iraq, where they've drawn pretty sharp differences between each other? But then there are other issues like Afghanistan, where I think that they are pretty close to having the same views.
Phone calls, we will take them in a moment. Our guest is Professor Charles Lipson on All Things Political this Monday morning, Professor of Political Science, Director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago, the center of the world these days. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. What does the new president need to do to stimulate the economy? What about help for the auto industry? We'll talk about that later, and feel free to bring that up here in the United States. The threat of terrorism, the possible cabinet appointments and who you think should be there, and whatever else you'd like to bring up political. Senator John McCain's meeting with President-elect Obama in Chicago today. Our phone lines are all filled, but just keep the number in mind and you'll be able to get through, I'm sure, sometime during the hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls we go, and we start with John from Madison. Hi, John.
Hi, I've got two questions for you. One is, we're stalled in Afghanistan. Whether we've, you know, diverted forces to Iraq or not doesn't interest me. We deposed the Taliban, and we've got Karzai and the northern tribes vying for power there in addition to the Taliban. Why not just leave the country and let them sort out their own things? We're never going to exterminate the Taliban or Al-Qaeda there. I'm convinced of that. The Pakistan people actually support the Taliban, so why not get out? My second question is this. Do you think there's any chance that Obama is going to deviate at all from the post-Cold War Clinton-Bush national security strategy of full-spectrum dominance? It's kind of a unilateral, imperialistic, massive foreign-based structure program. Do you think Obama could change this at all, or is there just too much momentum from the military-industrial complex?
Well, let's take them in order. I think that the reason that the United States went into Afghanistan, one of the world's least promising places to install a democracy, as you said, John, was not that we wanted to go there, but that we went there in order to disrupt a regime that was providing a safe haven for the people who had knocked down the Twin Towers and would kill as many Americans as they could possibly kill. These were training camps. It's not clear whether the Taliban was controlling the space and letting Al-Qaeda work there, whether Al-Qaeda was there and letting the Taliban govern. That's the reason that we're still there. That's the reason that we're using special forces in the tribal areas. It's not that we have any particular stake in that region other than trying to disrupt terrorist organizations from being implanted there. But as long as we're in there, we would rather have friendly rather than unfriendly governments. Obama has said, if anything, that he would increase our resources there. What's happened in terms of the way that the military is organized to do that is that General Petraeus, who was in charge of Iraq alone, has now been promoted to a job that puts him in charge of Iraq and Afghanistan and those tribal areas in Pakistan. He's got a trusted aide who's now Ray Odierno, who was really part of the wrong solution in the early days in Iraq and has completely reversed himself and is now on the same page as Petraeus, who's doing Iraq. It remains to be seen if we have enough resources to do that. But the reason that we're there is not of our own choosing exactly. We don't think that we can do great things there. It's really that we're trying to prevent bad things from happening there. Will we try to be full spectrum dominant? As you say, I think that the big issue facing the military now, besides the fact that there'll be budget crunch on that, you've already heard the liberal wing of the Democratic Party say something that's rather similar to the implications of your question, which is that we should cut back on these expenditures, and there'll be budget pressures to do the same. I think that the big question is whether or not our military is really reconfigured from a big wars against a foe like Russia or China in the future to a force that's much more agile and designed to deal with small wars involving terrorists.
Thanks, John, very much for your call. Let's go to Jeff next from Eau Claire. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for your wonderful programs.
Thank you.
I just want to change gears a little bit. I wonder if the guest could comment on the what's going on with the automobile industry and the bailout package. My first inclination is to not support it, but I'm looking at it a little bit more and saying it could be an opportunity for big changes, some restrictions, some limitations. A big change in the automobile industry on how we get around?
It's a great question, Jeff. My sense is that the initial bailout, as I said earlier, was all about preventing a contagion effect in the financial sector, which could knock a lot of things down. Obama has already stated that he's interested in some kind of bailout. Because of employment effects in the area, but it's worth noting that most American cars are not just sold to Americans by foreign makers. A lot of those foreign makers are producing cars here. If you drive down I-65 from Chicago or from outside of Chicago to Indianapolis and on further south, you see lots of foreign automobile manufacturers. There's a huge Subaru plant between Chicago and Indianapolis, for example. So I think that there's a real question about whether and how we would engage in such a bailout. There's also a question is who would take the pain. Automobile workers make a lot of money. They make more than virtually any other hourly workers in the United States. They're very high-paid manufacturing workers. So there's a question about whether or not they would take any pain as well. One of the things that you see in the paper today is that the automobile union people are together arm in arm with the heads of GM and all the other big automobile makers asking to get their hands in the taxpayers' pockets. Let me state one more thing about this whole bailout in general. There are real losses in the economy. I don't have to tell that to any of your listeners who have checked their 401ks.
Sure.
There are real losses out there. People who owned houses that were worth $300,000 now own houses that are worth $225,000. If they owed $250,000 on those houses, they have to wonder if they should keep paying their mortgages. So what's going on right now is there's a dance between who will pay for those losses. They're real losses. Will it be the government? Will it be the people who own the shares of stock in those companies or own the houses themselves, or will it be the bondholders? And what you're seeing is that everybody who owns a little bit of a house or owns a little bit of stock or bonds is trying to get the taxpayer to shoulder all this bill. We don't know what the Obama administration wants to do and how they'll work together with Pelosi, Reid, and the Democrats on the Hill.
How many jobs do you think would be lost if a good portion of the domestic auto industry went under? People who make parts for cars, et cetera. And the second part of the question is this a chance for us to move the auto business into a whole different kind of retool the whole industry so that we're looking at green technology, we're just moving it in a different direction?
Well, there would be tens of thousands of jobs lost, but it would depend upon who took up the slack. That is, if people are still buying cars, then Honda and Subaru and mm-hmm. Toyota are still going to make them. And the question then is, where are they going to make them? There's a huge automobile factory outside of Jackson, Mississippi that's being built. There's already one big one that was there. And I can't remember which of the Japanese automakers was doing it. I think it was Toyota, but I could be wrong, that was able on virtually a dime as the market changed to say, we're not going to build the big vehicles. We're going to build the small vehicles. And they were able to do that within a few months, whereas a Detroit factory could simply never do it. And the reason that the Detroit factories couldn't do it is that they build all of these vehicles on very different platforms with very different assembly lines, whereas the foreign automobile makers have been able to do it on the same assembly line, so they can change much more quickly. We just have an industry that can't compete. It's hard for all automobile makers because sales have dropped, but it's been harder for American automobile makers for two reasons. One is that they focused entirely on large gas-guzzling mm-hmm. vehicles, and the other is that they have a structure of payments both for retirement and health care that's simply out of line with the cost structure of the rest of the industry.
Mm. More phone calls. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and our guest is Professor Charles Lipson, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago. Thanks very much, Jeff, for your call. We have a couple lines open if you've been trying to get through. Ray from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Ray.
Good morning. I'd like to backtrack a little bit to what your guest was saying at the beginning of the show. He was speaking about terrorists. We're going to test us. Could we broaden the definition of terrorist from here on out to include bankers and the mortgage people? Because the feeling a lot of old folks have around my house, where I live here in Milwaukee, is a feeling of terror. They don't know if they're going to be able to stay in their homes that they have lived in for 30 years, because most of their retirement has been recently gobbled up by these terrorist bankers and mortgage people. So let's from now on include the bankers and the mortgage folks when we're talking about terrorism. And that is the real first test Mr. Obama is going to deal with, is how is he going to make the average American feel secure that they can stay in their homes? Now, the question I really wanted to ask was, I voted for Mr. Obama, and I was one of the happiest days of my life, the night he won. But I am already beginning to get disgusted by the things I'm seeing coming out. The New York Times 2 days ago printed the facts that a large majority of the 150 staff members he's bringing in the White House are directly connected to or are lobbyists. And the only restrictions he's putting on them is a 12-month restriction. How about if we bring in 150 people that have nothing to do with these lobbyists? Because these are the people that have been terrorizing us from within our own country. And if we don't wake up to this fact and we keep hiding our heads in the sand, oh, these people from overseas are going to swim across the ocean and they're going to attack us here. We're being attacked right now from within our own country.
All right, I need to hold you there so we can get an answer. Professor Lipson.
That was simply a statement. There was no question.
Mm-hmm. What about the lobbyists that he's – can you want to comment on that, the number of lobbyists?
Well, the issue that Obama faces – is where do you get people who are experienced and competent, and where are those people now? And where they are now is they're either lobbying or they're working for large institutions, or they're working on Capitol Hill in senior positions. Many of them already held positions in the Clinton administration. So the issue is, how do you reconcile change, which is the central promise that Barack Obama made, with people who have some experience in handling these things? But I think that the caller has put his finger on something when he says that there's a tremendous feeling of concern out there.
Yes.
I think it's about two things. One is, will there be change? And the other is, is there a bottom to this crisis? I think if there's a bottom to this crisis, people won't look so much at where the answers have come from.
Let's go to an email. Nicole in Madison. I'm relatively new to presidential politics, but I find it interesting so many Republicans are being considered for cabinet and administrative positions. Over the weekend, Governor Schwarzenegger was asked if he planned to go to Washington. He basically said, not for 2 years, and then Obama's meeting with McCain. I wonder how many Democrats were considered to help out with the Bush administration. I also wonder how many Republicans were asked to work under Clinton.
Well, I think that the fundamental issue here is whether or not Obama plans to govern from the left or govern from the center. Bill Clinton began his administration by governing, in effect, from the left. He was defeated in the 94 elections. Those were the Newt Gingrich Contract with America elections. And basically, they fired people like Robert Reich and others who were associated with the more left-wing strategies of the administration. And they gave more prominent positions to people like Robert Rubin, who favored balancing the budget and were more centrist. So I think what you really ought to be looking at is not just can Obama reach across the aisle, but who within the Democratic Party is he going to look to? One of the interesting things about this overwhelming Democratic victory is that for the first time in a long time, it brought in some more conservative Democrats from the South and the Sun Belt. Those people will be very vulnerable if Obama runs from the left. So there'll be pressure within the Democratic Party as well. There's not much pressure from the old sort of centrist Republican wing of the party. It's been virtually eliminated. There are a few people like Susan Collins from Maine, but figures like Chris Shays, a Republican senator, congressman from Connecticut, they were defeated. A lot of those people have retired, but there will be pressure from the Democrats.
Thanks, Ray, for your call. Mike is next from Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you this
Fine.
Morning?
Fine, how are you?
Yes, I am wondering about the situation to terrorism as it is related to Canada and our ability to travel back and forth. There are two reasons I'm interested in. No, because I plan a trip to the Calgary Stampede in 2010, and I hope I can make it. And also to the fact that Canada may start challenging its defenses in it, on its own instead of depending on us. And also to one more. You probably all notice that most of our city buses in this country now are made in Canada. Could he cooperate? Could he comment, please?
Okay.
We have a very tight economic integration with Canada, and anything that restricts that border flow will be a real will have really harmful effects on our economy and all the rest. If you go to cities like Detroit, or any of the other border cities up near Vancouver on the West Coast, there's huge amounts of traffic. I think that the you get some slowing down, of course, because of things like the inspections that we now have to do at airports. We do a simpler version at the border. But I think that the only way that you can cope with those things is by having better border security in Canada itself from people who are coming in from the outside. If you start looking for where the real problems can come, they can come in shipping containers that come in sealed from some location in Asia or Europe and where something bad is put in there. Or you can get people in and out of the United States or Canada relatively easily, unfortunately. I think the only way you do that is not only with border security, but you have to do a lot more human intelligence overseas and close to home to find out where these terrorist networks are. And you have to do that in ways that leave people with their freedoms. The one point that Obama has consistently made is he's not going to chuck aside basic civil liberties in order to provide what he thinks is a kind of false security. He thinks that we can do this kind of surveillance in ways that are consistent with our civil rights.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Gayanne is next from Wacoma, Iowa. Hi, Gayanne.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. I'm interested in questions concerning who would be a pick for Secretary of Agriculture.
Yeah, there's one that hasn't been mentioned very often. Professor Lipson?
I haven't heard any speculation, but I'm not in the agriculture field. The agriculture field is one of those areas that has changed quite dramatically over the last years. I come from an agricultural area. I grew up in a cotton and soybean farming area of Mississippi in a small town. The Secretary of Agriculture, just like Gayanne was saying, was the most important appointment people that the government could make in areas where there's been tremendous subsidies for corn in order to make ethanol. The nature of these subsidies and the cost to the government, it's going to be a very big issue. And the fact that our trade relationships, the world trade system is on kind of life support right now, and the United States is a huge exporter of agricultural produce. Obama has talked a lot about restricting our commitments to international trade institutions. So whoever comes in as the agriculture secretary is going to want to know what kind of commitments we have to that international trade. I haven't heard any names. Gayanne, have you?
You know, Rhonda reminds me that Governor Vilsack has been named, or not named. His name has been mentioned, though.
I'm interested in Denise O'Brien, who ran for Secretary of Agriculture in Iowa 2 years ago. She's a 30-year farmer, an organic farmer from southern Iowa, and I know her from Women, Food, and Agriculture, a policy group. I have a farm, and we supply food there to the conferences.
Gayanne, can I ask you a question? What are the biggest agricultural policy issues that you would like a new secretary to address? I'm sure that there are people all over Wisconsin who are interested in that.
Yes. I want to address the subsidies for corn and soybeans and how they are ruining our soil, our economies, our farm communities. I think they should be totally banned. They're ruining the land. You know,
well,
and I've repeatedly asked the Obama folks about
no, they actually they've actually been committed on it. It's an excellent and interesting question. We're moving. Obama actually, my sense was that he was actually supportive of a number of these subsidies. It was McCain who opposed them, walked right into Iowa and said that he opposed them on general grounds, but I think that we're going to face, for financial and ecological reasons, the ones that you stated, the ecological reasons, a need to phase down those supports for corn. The price of corn is very high because corn has been diverted to make fuel. It's not even clear that the fuel that goes into making corn for ethanol produces net energy.
Thanks very much. And if you want to send us more information, Gayanne, about what you're doing in the organization in Iowa, we'd be interested probably in doing a show. So send us an email, Fanning. Send Rhonda an email, fanning@wpr.org. And you could put my name on it, too, which is dunk@wpr.org. Listen to you, Professor Lipson. You sound like a professor of agriculture. That was good.
I'm just sitting here in my bib overalls wearing a John Deere hat.
All right. let's go next.
No, actually, I was talking with a farmer last weekend at a wedding. He was a man nearing 90 who was still farming in Kansas. And I said, he actually had on bib overalls. And I said, you've got everything but the John Deere hat. And he gave me the perfect farmer's answer. He said, I'm a harvester, man.
Let's pause for just a moment. And we'll welcome more of your phone calls. Thanks, Ann, for your call. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our phone number here is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, and let's go to Walt from Madison. Hi, Walt.
Hi.
Hi.
General Motors, part of the, they want to borrow money. I heard about $25 billion to pay their workers' health plans, and I'm thinking that if we had a national health plan like single payer, then they would not have to pay, $1,000 plus for each car that's produced. The Japanese have a national health plan over there, therefore they do not have to pay this health the workers, and I'm just thinking, wouldn't that be good for not only General Motors but the whole United States? I'm going to take the answer on the radio,
right?
Because I don't hear well here.
Okay, Walt, thanks for the call.
Walt has put his finger on something that's extremely important for several reasons. First of all, everybody who does not have health coverage, it's one of the top two worries on their list alongside whether I'll be employed tomorrow. Healthcare, if you've got a health crisis which could come up at any time, it can bankrupt you if you have no health insurance or if you have poor health insurance. Also, if you have a big medical center like those in Milwaukee, Madison, any of the other cities, they end up essentially bearing a lot of the costs of these uninsured patients. So there are a lot of hospitals that are also at risk. One of the questions that you have to Walt's point is also correct in the sense that every union that's out there has put health care payment by the government at the top of their list. When I listed the three big issues confronting incoming President Obama, I listed the economic crisis as one, a series of foreign challenges as two, and health care as three. I actually am not putting two and three in that order. They are both important, and they have to be handled simultaneously. Obama himself has made health care a high priority. So I think Walt is on the right track. But I think that any bailout of the automobile industry that includes the pensions and health care of automobile workers has to ask yourself, why should the general American public pay for the health care of those workers when the general public needs its own health care? Why should you, who may not have such good health care, be paying for a union worker's retirement and health care when you may not have such a great retirement program yourself? So I think that there are very, very important questions that the Obama administration won't have any luxury of time in going about answering.
Let's talk about the Republicans for a moment. Who has a political future in the Republican Party? And considering the fact that there don't seem to be too many really strong leaders now, who's going to be able to fashion the kind of loyal opposition, smart opposition, different ideas that probably, well, that the Obama administration has said that they welcome somebody to challenge his thoughts about things?
Well, I think that the first issue for the Republicans is to try to figure a path out of the wilderness. They became very quickly a governing party that had made a pact with the lobbyists. They were perceived as out of touch. George Bush adopted big government and moved. He was a big government conservative, whatever conservative means in that sense. He moved sharply away from Ronald Reagan's programs to sort of make government smaller. So I think that there's going to be a fight over the heart and soul of the Republican Party about what direction they're going to move, just as there was a fight among the Democrats for many years about whether to move to the center or to move to the left. Clinton moved to the center. He was elected. And Obama has moved to the left. He was elected. It's a bit unclear whether he was elected on the leftist policies or because he was the clearest candidate of change.
Let's go to Jim next from Viroqua. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my
call. Sure.
Hey, I wanted to tell you, I think your guest just hit on a very important point about this. Why should the American public pick up the health care for auto workers? And really, that hits at a much, much larger question of, health care, I think, in this country needs to be Obama's number one domestic issue. And I think you made a good point on that. But I did want to call about agriculture and about corn and ethanol in particular because, you know, your guest himself said that, you know, he's not an agricultural expert, but everybody seems to have an opinion that ethanol is bad. Well, first of all, ethanol was not the real source of the spike in corn prices up to around $7 this year. I mean, corn is back down to about $3 to $4, and I believe that speculators and Wall Street were a big part of the reason for that spike is people pushed up prices on a lot of different commodities. Ethanol really is subsidized much less than the oil industry has been, and I think most people would say that, hey, you eliminate the subsidies for the oil industry and give everybody a level playing field. But I'm involved in agriculture. I'm a farmer and a manufacturer, and it is possible to raise corn in ways that are friendly for the environment and where there is a positive energy balance. And I just would think people need to be careful because ethanol has put schools in. It's brought people back to the countryside. You go through South Dakota, towns that were dying now have a local market for local products. The price is posted out on the street. You're not on the road at the sign. You're not dependent on what somebody in LaSalle Street wants to pay you to ship ground corn down in New Orleans, and I thank you for taking my call.
Okay, thanks.
Well, I take the point, Kathleen, that you've got to have a program on agricultural prices.
Yeah, we do. But, we need another one.
The fact is, these are hotly debated issues, but I think that the future for alternative energy is very bright. I think that it's time for us to have a major push in that direction. High prices have done a lot. I read a lot about the technology of energy. And the key here is going to be figuring out ways to use the sun better, to use the wind better. By the way, we had earlier questions about infrastructure. One area of infrastructure we desperately need to have upgraded is the power distribution network. The ways you get power from across the country, because where power is used and where it is generated are different places, and the only way you can get it from one to the other is with an upgraded power distribution network. The other thing is on renewables. We need to figure out ways to consume the non-edible parts of the plant, the stalk of the corn and all the rest. That's a hard technological challenge, but there are people at universities all over Wisconsin who are working on that while we speak.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a few more people because a lot of these people are Chicago people and you knew them. You know them. You were mentioning David Axelrod earlier, who really helped run a brilliant campaign. How will he be serving Obama in the White House? What does it mean to be a senior advisor?
Well, Axelrod himself says that he's not a policy person. He's basic. So Karl Rove, when he was in the White House, was constantly looking at the politics, but he was also giving some policy advice. My hunch is that Axelrod will be more on the political advice and not the policy advice side. But he has close associates, people like Valerie Jarrett here in Chicago, who is a very experienced political operative. There are a number – all of these people who he surrounded himself with have a lot of political experience at the local level, and the question is how well will that translate up to the Hill? You remember when Jimmy Carter came in 1976, he brought with him a set of people who sort of looked down on the co-workers that they would have up on the Hill. So Tip O'Neill, even though he was a Democrat, found that he was essentially on the outs with the people who were in the Carter White House. Bringing in Rahm Emanuel, who is an extremely tough, experienced operator who was the number four person on Capitol Hill and who knows Pelosi well, will serve him well in terms of crafting that legislative agenda.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he's reading Lincoln, too. What do you think he's gleaning from Abraham Lincoln during this transition period?
Well, I hope he's reading something about the incredible moral courage that Lincoln showed in the face of the greatest challenge since the founding of the Republic. You've got to remember that the Lincoln that we know and love came to be kind of admired in retrospect. Had Sherman not taken Atlanta, Lincoln was not favored to win re-election. It was unclear whether he was going to win a second term. The other thing that Lincoln did was he switched the people he counted on in the military when they couldn't get the job done. One of the greatest failures among many of the George W. Bush administration was holding on Rumsfeld and holding on the people in Iraq when it was clear that their strategy, which was kill as many of the bad guys as you can, was not working effectively. So I hope that one of the things that Obama will do is not only pick competent people, but fire them as soon as it's clear that they can't get the job done.
Thank you so much for being with us. It was a great hour. Thanks. We'll talk to you again, I hope.
My pleasure, Kathleen. My pleasure.
Professor Charles Lipson, Professor of Political Science, Director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program and for on-air production. We return following the news on the Ideas Network.